Good evening and welcome to the 2012 Summer Lecture Series in Jewish History. This year's Summer Lecture Series is entitled, as you can see, The War Against the Jewish Book. I give you Rabbi Katz.
Thank you, Ari. Welcome. As said, we have a long haul to go between now and Tisha B'Av, as you can understand. That's why I started a little bit early to make it all work out. And without any further ado, let's get right down to business. As you know, this is, I think, the fifth time we're doing this, fifth or sixth. I try to devote the summers, because of the nature of the 3 weeks, to some tragic aspect of the Jewish past, and we have no shortage. This is not Switzerland with a boring history, okay? We've been through a lot of tough times, as the prophet says long ago, Sheva Yipol Tzadik V'Kam, the Jewish people, like the ancient righteous person, can take seven hits and knock down and get up again. What's significant in our history is not only that we'd be knocked down, which has happened, but we get up. But the study of the past and the stuff we've had to put up with, I think, is instructive. And although no one ever really learns from the mistakes of the past, maybe we will a little bit. And in that light, I wanted to devote this year's, the series, to a kind of a fairly broad theme, which I thought of in connection with my recent trip to Italy, and therefore the home of the Catholic Church, and the home of a long, long Jewish community going back far away, and therefore of relationships between Christianity, Western Christianity on the one hand, and Judaism on the other, which is an interesting one, and it ain't over. Because, as we'll see, the Catholic Church certainly is still a work in progress in how they relate to the Jewish people and to Judaism. Interestingly, it's something that they are working out themselves. The Jewish religion has somewhat of a different attitude, perhaps a maddening one, as we'll see. And therefore, I hope it'll be instructive as well as interesting. And certainly, the very title itself, The War Against the Jewish Book, indicates that we've gone through our share of violence physically, but we've also gone, and this is what I want to direct this year's set of talks about, we've also unfortunately had to undergo a fair amount of cultural violence. And those who know about, for example, today, the ever-spreading campaigns of disinvestment and things like that against Israel, know cultural violence is not funny. Sometimes it's, first of all, it leads to physical violence, and it also leads to terrible consequences across the board. So without any further introduction, let me get right down into it in the subject of the war against the Jewish book. And I start by saying that although we Jews like to call ourselves, and it's fairly often heard, people of the book, it's not exactly true. We've only been the people of the book for about 1,500 years. Compared to America, that's a long time. Compared to many other countries, it's not. And what I'm really saying is, for the first half of our history, I repeat, for the first half of our history, the Jewish people actually, you'll be surprised, were the people without a book. Consider, we were for a long time in rabbinic culture. It's funny the way things developed. It's not like that now. But for a long time, we were in rabbinic culture, the Jews against books, right? In favor of orality. Just the very idea of the Torah Shebichtav of the Bible is not as ancient as you think. Maybe the Chumash is, but you'd have to go back, even in Jewish tradition, to the time of the Anshei Knesset HaGadol and all, the time of Ezra and those parts, which is fairly well along after 1,000 years in Jewish history or so, to the times when they took the step, not so willingly, but they took the steps to create the Tanakh itself, the Nevi'im and Ksuvim. The Book of Books, the famous Jewish traditional take on this is that's a fairly late origin. There was a time long ago, in the first 1,000 years of our history or so, something like that, what we call the First Temple Era and those centuries when Jews were in Israel. There was the Chumash, the Five Books of Moses, and that was the totality of the sacred books. There were literate Jews, there were literate society. There were probably people who wrote scrolls and things like this. We have records, mentions of them throughout the Tanakh. I'll just give you one example that anyone with the slightest acquaintance with the biblical text will know. Every time a king dies in ancient Israel, it says all the rest of what he did are written in the books of the chronicles of the kings of Judah or kings of Israel. So there were such books or texts running around. There are other references here and there. It says a literate society, and yet Jewish books in the sense of the controlling and sacred literature, it was just the five books of Moses, and that's the way they wanted it. Therefore, imagine if you lived in the 800 BC, that kind of time, 700 BC, David HaMelech, the kings of Judah, of Israel, what was there actually in the way of text? Free market. There were prophets in those days, plenty of them, a lot more than we know of, and they must have written stuff. Where is it? There were false prophets we know all the time. The Bible is full of such characters. Navi Sheker, they wrote stuff. Where is it? There were governments and societies. I don't know if they wrote novels, but there were written texts running around. Where are they? And the answer is they're all gone because beginning of the Second Temple period, the traditional Jewish take on this is that, in time Ezra and Nehemiah as they call it, the men of Great Assembly, the Sanhedrin, to use an anachronistic term, said, we don't like the fact that all these books are floating around and the public doesn't know what's right or what's wrong or what is and what isn't, and we're going to appoint ourselves a censorship and editorial commission, and we're going to go through all the books and we're going to decide in two piles what goes in and what stays out, and whatever goes out, we're going to burn or get rid of as much as we can. So we're the ones who started the book burning business long ago. Okay, if you want to get accurate about it. And we called them the men of the Great Assembly, Knesset Gdolah, because what they ended up with turned out in the long run to be a very powerful, the creation of a very powerful institution of a Jewish community and survival, which we kind of take for granted because you always take for granted the air that you breathe. And I'm referring to the Bible, the Tanakh itself. Because by the time they finished, what they ended up with was the 24 books of what we call the Torah Nevi'im HaKesuvim, which every Jew has, and almost the same version. You know, maybe a few changes here and there, but basically the same. And it has become what Heinrich Heine very famously called the portable fatherland, which means that wherever you are around the world, from then till today, we all have this much in common. We got the same book. Now, we can argue over the book, and we can disagree with it. We can battle over its legitimacy. We can do this. We're talking about the same book. If, on the other hand, we're talking about different books, we can't even have a conversation. We cannot even have an argument. I'll give you a perfect example of what I'm talking about. Can you debate somebody, anyone here, about the Ethiopian sacred literature of the Jews of Ethiopia and that kind of thing? Well, we don't know what it is even. You see what I mean? So you can't even have a conversation. The very fact that you all have the same book allows us to communicate, even argue, because it's a commonality, as a family does, because they're arguing over what to do with grandpa's becher. We all know what we're talking about. It's the same thing. And so they created, consciously, a powerful centripetal influence which enables the Jews to survive the terrible centrifugal forces which will characterize the diaspora which is going to emerge in the late Second Temple and post-Second Temple period, which constitutes the essential Jewish reality today. So I repeat, I can go anywhere in the world, and to be perfectly frank, you go Orthodox, conservative, Reform, or whatever, and you can walk in, it's the same Chumash, the same Bible. It might interpret it differently. You might have disagreements of what's on the bottom, right? In the commentaries, it's the same text. It's interesting. And so they did this by burning all the other books and saying no one should ever have anything with any other things. They call them Sfarim Chitzonim. The Mishnah says whoever reads them goes straight to hell. But these 24 will remain the books. And what that means is that for quite a number of centuries, the Jewish authorities, such as they were, fought a battle to prevent any new texts from being added to the canon and messing up what they saw as this kind of pristine, small set of texts that all Jews can subscribe to. It's interesting. Furthermore, they already developed a long time ago an attitude which is going to be very pertinent to what we're going to be talking about in this series, which is keep everything in-house and don't let the Gentiles know about it. It wasn't, let's tell our story to others. They didn't want to do that. They said, let's keep it in-house. But on the other hand, as you can imagine, Jews, you have no unanimity. You can never really get a consensus on anything. Ask anyone involved in Jewish organizational life. But one area of disagreement over this had to do with the following. Not that long after the time Ezra and Nehemiah, you know, whatever, whether it's a short time or a longer time, Alexander the Great conquers the Persian Empire, and the Jews enter what they call the Hellenistic era. And so they live in the era when the world is dominated by Greek culture. And you really start to get a diaspora in that you have significant Jewish communities living in places they don't speak Hebrew even. Like we in America, most of us, unfortunately, aren't good in Hebrew. We're better in English. I'm speaking at this very moment in English, even though I'm an Orthodox synagogue. And very significant communities, wealthy, important, and they wanted Art Scroll, so to speak. You know, they wanted some way of bridging the gap, the language barrier, between the text and themselves. And so what emerges out of all this is a series of attempts, one or another, to translate, for the first time ever, the Bible, the scripture, into Greek. The most famous is what you call the Septuagint, which I know many are famous with, the LXX, the 70, the Jewish elders who did it. Well, there are two versions of the story of the translation of the Bible into Greek. One is positive, one is negative. The positive one is written in Greek, not surprisingly. It's in the pseudepigrapha. It's called the Letter of Aristeus. And it's an old book, whether it's exactly accurate or not. But bottom line is, they say this was a great thing. The king of Egypt was a great guy. He invited all the Jewish elders to come to Alexandria in Egypt. He treated them with kid gloves, and he gave them a lot of presents and things like that. They have this big banquet in which they have all these very learned philosophical discussions. When it's all over, they go out into the Nile River on an island, and they translate the Bible into Greek, and everybody's happy. In the Talmud, the rabbinical side, the Haredi reaction, it was a fast day. You know? The 8th of Teves. We just fold it together now into Asar B'Teves. When you do the Slichos, those who do, read the Slichos, on the famous fast day of the Asar B'Teves, the 10th of Teves, it says, on the 8th day, in Sani Melch Yovan Licht of Das Yavonis, the Greek king, meaning the king of Egypt, Ptolemy II, forced me to translate the Bible in the Greek. The 9th day was something else, the 10th day was something else. Can't ask people to fast 3 days in a row, put it all together in the 10th day. But in other words, they strongly disapproved, I repeat. And they disapproved because we don't want our stuff getting out there. And to be perfectly honest, I spoke about this once downtown at Deloitte Street. With the publication of the Bible into Greek, you get the beginnings of an anti-Semitism. Because there's a lot of things in there that people could find offensive. In general, who says you're the chosen people? What about me? Secondly, if you're an Egyptian, the Bible is definitely an anti-Egyptian rant. Right? Egypt comes out looking bad and stupid too. Pharaoh said, you will not go. And Moses says, yes, we will. And Pharaoh says, Miasha, who is the Lord? I don't have to listen to him. And we all know the end of the story. You get what I'm saying? If it's in-house, if someone else doesn't know about it, there's no harm done. If it gets out there, there are consequences. I can assure you that I'm not the one that says this. Scholars on the subject will tell you, modern anti-Semitism can be traced back to ancient Alexandria. There's a line from the modern times to Protocols of Elder Zion to Henry IV to this, that, and the other, down to the times of Appian and earlier than that in Alexandria after the translation of the Bible into Greek. And so the rabbis knew what they're talking about in that kind of a sense. So we're not necessarily so hotsy-totsy about translating, putting books out there or more books than they're already there. We're not even so crazy about putting translations out there. And let me tell you something. I personally have had the experience. I once Googled myself, just want to see what's on there. Nazi website. Why am I on a Nazi website? I translated the part of the Art Scroll, Gemara Sanhedrin, among other things. And in there, you have all kind of agadatas. And some of those agadatas are not complimentary towards people who are not Jewish. They're right on the Nazi website. In other words, they took the trouble to do it. It was a little disconcerting to myself, but it goes to show you what you and I already know, which is in the age of YouTube and all the rest of it, you got to watch what you say and keep your mouth shut. And watch what you write and print. We are sensitized to this now because of modern technology, but it's a fairly new consciousness. It's a fairly new sensibility. Once upon a time, a person wrote something in Chinese, he could reasonably expect that people who are not Chinese would not ever read it. You see? So the world has shrunk in the technological sense, as we all know, and it's shrinking smaller and smaller all the time, thanks to, you know, YouTube and the internet and all the rest of it. If that's true about the... Let me just add one more point. This is the reason why official Judaism, Orthodox Judaism, traditional Judaism, has always been very rejectionist towards the Apocrypha and Pseudepigrapha and those kinds of books. These are texts that were written by Jews very often in the Second Temple period. That's old. And the from Jews were always looking at them as askance and either semi-rejectionist or totally rejectionist. I live with this because every time Hanukkah comes around, for example, the original source, if you want to get down to it, of the actual history of the campaigns of Judah Maccabee, the very name Maccabee itself, is only in the apocryphal works. The Apocrypha is a name given by the church to a number of texts, 17, 18, 19 texts, from the Second Temple period, written by Jews mostly, having nothing to do with Christianity, which are included by the Christians for their purposes in the New Testament. I repeat, they are pre-Christian, have nothing with Christianity. Four of them would be Maccabees 1, 2, 3, and 4. So all the stories that you grew up with, and I grew up with, about Judah Maccabee and how the guy said, who wants to step forward and offer the sacrifice to the Greeks? And one said, I will do it. And Mattathias said, oh yeah, and he stabbed him again. That's not in the Gemara. It's not in Chazal. I promise you, the word Maccabee itself does not appear in rabbinic literature, even though we were all grown up to hear Micha Mocha Bohilim Hashem, but it's actually not true. And it's only in the Greek texts and rejected by official Judaism. So it's just interesting to consider the fact that Judaism had to wage a battle, and they did, for centuries, against what they viewed as contamination by outside texts claiming to be new and authoritative ones within our tradition. We're not a people of a book yet. And then that's the easy part. By the way, I'm referring to religious books over here, not Stam books, you understand. In other words, I'm sure there were Jews who wrote things. We were not an illiterate society. But I'm talking about official core doctrine, literature, that sort of thing. If that's true of the written law, what about the oral law, the Torah Sheva'al Peh? 100 times more so. The very notion and tradition that we have in Judaism, a definitional notion, a basic notion, that there's something called the oral laws itself, by itself, the name itself tells you, is not supposed to be written. In fact, the Gemara even says of itself that Dvarim Sheba'al Peh Yatar Rosh Ha'al Lichtov. You're not allowed to write down any of the non-Chumash stuff. They're opposed to that in principle. What they're therefore saying is God does not want it to happen that way. God wanted an oral religion. Isn't that interesting? If you go to a yeshiva, if you want to call it that, literally 1,500 years ago, 2,000 years ago, in the time of King David, what's a yeshiva? There's no books. You're not allowed to have books. It was a different kind of learning. Don't be anachronistic. Take off the glasses of the year 2012 and go back to the year 12 or 12 BCE or 112 BCE or past that. Were there people studying Judaism? Yeah, what was it? That's a whole discussion, and I really can't get into it totally, but I'll get into it a little bit. It's a fascinating discussion that deserves fuller treatment elsewhere, but I'll touch on it for our purposes now. If you think it through, I would argue that the way God wanted it, not the way we have it today, the way God wanted it was that you don't study a text because they're against text in principle, but you study people. Long ago, if I can go in a time machine 2,500 years ago or 3,000 years ago, and you went to study with, for example, Eliyahu HaNavi or whatever it is, you studied the man. There were no books. There were no texts. It's not like he memorized stuff and gave it over to you. I assure you, they were in principle opposed to the idea of a text. They wanted everything to be that each teacher should say it in his way, uniquely, and it'll work for you and I. You know, we can establish a hookup intellectually this way, or not. I'll say, this is not the way it works for me. I'll go to the other person. It's a different kind of educational idea. You understand? The Igeres of Shir HaGaon was written in the year 987, one of the Gaonim in Babylonia. This is in the immediate post-Talmudic period. Has a long discussion of this. It's very fascinating. And he says they were, in the older generations, they were opposed to having any kind of a text. And you can give the same material over, but everyone will do it in a different way. I always like to say the world is divided into mathematicians and humanists, and I'm not a mathematician. Mathematical types are very systematic. They have a certain approach, and they would tell you, you want to learn Shabbos? Keep this in mind. There are 39 malachas and, 416 subparagraphs that can be divided by three general overarching categories, and some people eat that up, and I would fall asleep. And there are other people who would be raconteurs. And we'll tell you the same law, right? And the person would say, tell me about Shabbos. You know, it's a funny thing. I had a case once, not that long ago. It's actually a brother-in-law of mine. Came on Shabbos, and the challah had overcooked, and it was a case of klisheni, right? And I told him this and that and the other, and the student would say, why'd you do that? Well, you have to understand, it was this and this situation. All the, you understand what I'm saying? You're studying the person and his approach to the law, his approach to the text of the Torah itself. That's unique. That cannot be conveyed on paper. Once you put it in any kind of fixed form, it's frozen after that. So they were opposed to this, and they made it work for 1,500 years. And then the system broke down, we're told, and eventually they had to convert from that into something different. There was a great transformation from a free form in principle to a fixed text and then to a written text. I always like to tell, for those who are able to follow, there's a very famous Mishnah, very briefly, at the beginning of Pesachim. I didn't bring it with me, where it says, many will be familiar with this, it says, Orla, our boss, our broken, and the night before Pesach, you still do Bedikas Chametz. And Komachin, Shem, Machin, Shem, Chametz, in Sark Bedika. And you don't have to make a Bedikas Chametz as a place where you're sure you never put Chametz. And then it goes on to say, Ba'me Amru, Shtei Shuras, Ba'martev. It says, then why did you say, why did they, the Mishnah says, why did they say that you do two rows in the cellar? I thought you'd have to check where they never put it. That actually is a place where people bring chametz because waiters and butlers sometimes go down with a cheese sandwich when they come to bring the wine up and they might leave something a sandwich behind. The Mishnah itself is referring to some older text. It's when did they say two rows? I mean, they're referring there to some oral tradition which they're not even sure of by this time. There's a whole lot to this. But I just want to get across the idea that once upon a time we had notebooks, and we were against them. We're against them in principle. We want it to be that you study Shabbos and Kashrus and Taras Mishpacha and interhuman relationships and Gemilas Chasanim and 100 different things by studying with a person, a great person that you feel is great, and you watch what he or she, I don't know, does under a whole wide variety of circumstances over the course of years, and then you pick up the Das Torah, as they talk, what they talk about. You didn't read texts and memorize them and pass tests. That was antithetical to the system, what it originally wanted. I'm going here for a reason. But suffice it to say that more or less around 400 BC, something like that, a process begins which takes close to 1,000 years. And the Jewish religion, core religious ideas, are transformed from a totally non-textual one to the opposite, to books. We know what the train looked like at the beginning, no books. And we know what the train looks like at the end. It says they converted into a bunch of books, which we call the Talmud. That's what the Gemara, the Talmud in general. And bring a chart, but over the course of several centuries, they produce 10, 15 books, the Mishnah, the Tosefta, eventually with the Golda Gemara, the Medrash. These things collectively are called the Talmud. These are the first books ever put out. And, the Talmud itself is apologetic about it. They say Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi did the Mishnah because he felt it was a Rosh Hashanah emergency situation, it was being forgotten, or maybe because of the Roman Empire and pressure. Whatever. There were historical reasons that necessitated this revolutionary and radical change. But it happened. And that means that by the time you get to the end of the ancient period, the beginning of the Middle Ages, thereabouts, we've got books, right? I don't say they got out there and everybody read them, but the core Jewish values have, been transformed, not for the better. The Talmud says not for the better, but it's what they had to do by being put into text. Because as soon as you put in text, you freeze it in time, then it becomes a question, what does it mean? And second of all, you're conveying the idea that the same halacha applies for two people where it's not really, really true. It should be that if you really, really know what you're talking about, not for me or you, but for a real person, If you know what you're talking about, the same question asked by two different people, going to get two answers. Right? And not because of wishy-washy, because the person really knows what he's talking about. You understand? And there's no such thing as the same question having the same reality, because I'm not you and you're not me, and we all have different lives and circumstances. And now I can't do that, because now you got, most of the time, you got something called books. So the Mishnah Berurah says this, the halacha, so that's the end of it. Or, you know, someone like that. And that is what the system turned into, or began to turn into, when you get to the beginning of the Middle Ages, around the year 500 CE. So this is, as I say, a big transformation. Let me tell you something. We're not even sure when these things were actually put down on paper. I mentioned before, and I don't want to get too technical, there's something called the letter of Ashura Gaon, which is an ancient text. It survives in two versions. It's very well known, the French version and the Italian and the Spanish version. In the Spanish version, it says that they actually wrote it down on paper. In the French version, it always says, no, they just memorized these texts like griots. You know what I mean? Just memorized it orally. But even then, they were reluctant to write it down on paper until quite late in Jewish history. So our Talmudic era is not as old as many people might possibly think. Why am I going through all this? Because it means something very important. During the entire first 400 or 500 years of Christianity, the era of the beginnings of the religion, its growth and development, its spread across the Roman and the conquest of the Roman Empire, starting with our buddy Constantine over here. In the early 300s, he is, I'm sure you know, was the first Roman emperor to embrace Christianity one way or the other. So all during his time and afterwards, and later, the Christianity spreads beyond the Roman Empire into the rest of Europe, the Jewish people at that time had no other religious books other than the Bible. Don't be surprised if early Christianity never heard of the Talmud. It wasn't there. The Talmud is a book. A book means there's a time that it was written and a day before. We don't know exactly when the Gemara was written, but it was a time it didn't exist. Now, it's a complex topic, but it didn't exist once. And early Christianity rose and when? In the year 100, the year 200, 300, 400. There were no books among the Jews that they encountered. If they lived in Israel, maybe they saw rabbis having conversations. And you and I know these conversations in later period were put down on paper and became what we call the Gemara, but there are no books. And so as far as the Christians are concerned, the Jewish people are the people of the book. When I say book, the Bible, the Old Testament. And that's it. They don't know anything else. The notion of Torah Shel Peh, especially in the way that it gelled and evolved into a huge, complex, and rich business called the Talmud, is just something that was not known to them. Go back for a minute. We were just here in Rome a month ago. If anybody was, I see some people that were in there. There are two arches that survived, Archititus, Archiconstantine. Right? Archititus had to do with the Jews. Archiconstantine, very paganistic. The Senate gives it to Constantine. But as far as the Jews are concerned, his real so-and-so, because he was quite anti-Semitic. Okay? The reason he had the church switch from Saturday to Sunday was because it was offensive to him that Christians should celebrate the same Sabbath. He said, we don't want to do a Jewish thing. Ew. Okay? So, now, the Christians were quite aware that the Old Testament is written in Hebrew, and they knew that the Jews knew Hebrew and they didn't. I mean, they were aware of that sort of thing. The Christians were also aware, may I say, of the fact that their translation of the Bible, which is called the Vulgate, is less than excellent. They were not unaware of the fact. You understand what I'm saying? The Christian religion arose, and especially in Western Europe, the New Testament is written in Greek, but eventually nobody knew Greek in Western Europe and Italy and places like that. They translated, a guy named St. Jerome, Geronimo, translated into in the 300s. In the time of the Amoraim, he was anti-Semite, and he moved to Israel to learn Hebrew, enough Hebrew, for him to translate the Old Testament to his satisfaction. And, he got it basically right, but here and there is a fair number of mistakes. A classic example of where we would disagree with him, an obvious mistake, would be when they translate Lo Tirtzach in the Ten Commandments as Thou shalt not kill, and everybody knows it means Thou shalt not murder. I mean, it's a famous Rashbam said he debated this with Catholic priests. They actually asked him what it really means. Even we, who are not big Hebraists, know that there's a difference between Lo Tahrog and Lo Tirtzach. All right, I'm just trying to tell you that what that means is that they're pushing a religion whose foundation was the Old Testament. They don't understand the actual language of the Old Testament. If you ever run into a missionary, that's the first thing I always tell them. I say, can you read Hebrew? I know what you think is the truth. You understand? It's funny, but that's how it goes. So the church was aware of all this kind of stuff. The church, unlike the later Muslims, believed that the Hebrew scriptures is basically accurate, although I'm not saying they subscribe to the Rambam's 13 principles. By that I mean, if you asked Christians, and this was the doctrine of the Catholic Church, the Old Testament is really the Old Testament. You understand, in Islam, it's not that way. The Muslims are taught from early on that the Jews on purpose changed around and doctored the text of the Chumash and the Tanakh to make them look bad, make the Muslims look bad. Therefore, the Jews are so perfidious that they would even dare to tamper with God's words. That's who Jews are. And as a result, the Torah, when it was originally given by God, I'm telling you what Islam says. The Torah was originally given by God, was pristine and pure, and it was a great revelation, but you don't have it today. Because after the Jews got through with it, they messed it up. I mean, there's reasons for this. Muhammad in the Quran even says, I debated with Jews, and I said something about, I tried to tell them a story, a parable, based on what happened to Miriam, the mother of Moses, and Yocheved, his sister, and the Jews bent over, laughing and making fun of me. They said, you idiot, it's Miriam is the sister, and Yocheved is the mother. Don't you know anything? But I said, no, I'm right. And they showed me their Bible, and I said, you changed it and make me look bad. You understand? So, okay, that's what we're doing. But you can't argue with anybody, you know, they'll kill you. So the point is, we live in such a world. The point is that the Christians didn't have this attitude. They say the Old Testament is basically what it is. Unfortunately, early Christians argued, and probably still do, in a fascinating mirror image of the Jews, the Jews are stuck on a superficial understanding of the Tanakh. It's amazing, but both the Jews and the Catholics came up with the idea of pardes. Pshat, remez, drash, sod. Different ways of understanding a pasuk. Right? Yeah, I'm sure, I take it everybody knows what I'm talking about. The plain level, and the allegorical level, and this level, and that level. And in Christianity, and in Judaism, to be perfectly honest, the main interpretation, it was a big debate, it's always raged. Which is the main interpretation? The pshat, or the drash, or the sod? The sod is the Kabbalah, the mystical one. Which is the real heart of it? And of course, to a Christian, you read the Bible, and they read it not through the level of pshat. The Pope's right about this, I promise you. And they say, oh, the poor Jews are stuck in pshat. You understand? We understand, of course, that when it says there was Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, obviously one is the Father, one's the Son, and one's the Holy Ghost. That's the thing. The Jews say, hey, wait a minute. There was a guy named Avram. There was another guy named Yitzhak. There was another guy named Yaakov. Don't give me this business. So they couldn't really have a conversation, and the Jews didn't want to get at the level of drash and sod and all this with the Christians. That's one of the reasons why the Jewish biblical exegetes who lived in Ashkenaz, other than Rashi, were super heavy on pshat. People like the Chizkuni and the Paneich Roza, and even the Ibn Ezra in Spain to some degree or another, because whenever they were always battling with the Christians, they always wanted to assert the pshat. You understand? That's their way of battling the Christian interpretations. This doesn't mean Jesus. It means what it says. You know, what are you talking about? You know, that whole kind of approach. So the point is that the Christians did believe in the accuracy of the Old Testament. They just said the Jews themselves didn't understand it. And so a Christian would not heard a Sefer Torah. Get what I'm saying? Because it's the Bible. He would not destroy, typically anyway. I mean, I don't know if a pogrom got out of hand. But on a normal day-to-day basis, they're supposed to respect the Bible too. It's their Bible as well. I repeat, they say we don't understand it right. But they understand that it's a sacred book. They were regarded as Old Testaments. On the other hand, the Christians were not and could not have been aware of the slow evolution of the post-Churban rabbinic culture, whose elite rabbis were conducting the discussions over several centuries, which discussions were eventually written down, edited repeatedly, and ultimately published as a set of texts called the Talmud. They just weren't aware of all this was going on. After all, where is most of the activity of the Talmud happening? In Bavel, and to a lesser degree in Israel. Babylonia was outside the Christian zone. That was in what we call today Iraq, which is part of the Persian Empire, not the Roman Empire. There were some strange Christian sects in Babylonia, there were, but that's very far to periphery. The main center of Christianity, you know, was the Roman Empire, far off. And there is such a thing called the Tanoim and the Talmud Yerushalmi. There were rabbis, significant rabbis in the Talmud who lived in Israel, but the Christians killed them. That's what happened. The Talmud Yerushalmi was closed down because in the 360s, a little bit after the time of Constantine, like two generations later, they just went and killed them all. which is why the Yerushalmi just went kaput and the Talmud Bavli continued on for a century and a half. The point is that the Christians didn't deign or condescend to say, what are the Jews talking about? What are they actually doing over there and all the rest of it? They figured they must be doing Old Testament interpretations, blind Old Testament interpretations, superficial Old Testament interpretations. And they had no idea, as I said before, that an entire intellectual universe was being created on paper called the Talmud, you know, old Jewish traditions, of course, and was creating a new reality. And the new reality was the most significant reality of Jewish history, and it's called the Talmudization of Judaism. The Christians could not have had any idea about the Gemara, let's put it that way. Now, to be fair, many Jews, did not hear of the Talmud either for a long time. Just because a bunch of rabbis were doing something in this place or that place, Sur or Pumbediza, doesn't mean Jews elsewhere, for example, in the Roman Empire or in Turkey or in Egypt or Italy or places like that, knew what was going on over there. After all, the last of the Amoraim, the last players in the Talmudic process, died in the year 500, Ravina the second. That's pretty late, 500 CE. It's after the Western Roman Empire went down. And another century or century and a half of editing continue, what we call the Rabbanon Savaroi. And so the book that you and I are so familiar with, that we've translated in our scroll, the rest of it, didn't really get out there as a published work, whatever that meant before printing press, until, I don't know, the 600s? You know, maybe a little later even? At all. And it's got to take another 100 years at least to spread throughout what we call the Jewish world. Do you understand what I'm talking about? It's an absolute revolution in Jewish life, although we take it for granted because we've been doing it for 1,200 years. Once upon a time, the Gemara as a text did not exist. So let me just give you one example I'm talking about before I move on in this. You'll find in the Gemara all the time, I'm sure many know this, in the Mishnah and such places, Rabbi Akiva says that this particular animal is kosher. I don't know, Rabbi Gamliel says it's not. You know, those kind of debates. Or if you fry it this way or this, then you know, milking and fleshing. One says good, one says bad. Who's right and who's wrong? The answer is neither one's wrong. Are you telling me Rabbi Gamliel is wrong? You telling me Rabbi Akiva is wrong? The answer is they represented two different traditions. You understand? There were places where people followed the Rabbi Gamliel way, and he was giving the voice to that set of traditions and practices, and there was ones with Rabbi Akiva or something like that. Like we might say today, not exactly the same way, but one could say Sephardic Ashkenazic. Who's right, the one who eats kidney is or the one who doesn't eat kidney is? And it doesn't work like that. You see? They're different traditions. So eventually, these get involved in discussions in the Talmud. They get put on paper, and they get sort of ironed out, either explicitly or implicitly, or the future generations decided to come up with some kind of a final ruling out as a result of these discussions. And after that, let's say for argument's sake, that the consensus formed that the animal we're talking about is treif. Let's just say that. That's it, baby. Don't tell me, well, I'm going like somebody telling you. Doesn't work like that. We have a consensus forming, and then that becomes what we call today halacha. Isn't that interesting? The halacha comes out of, if you want to call it minhag, what people ended up deciding to do, which position ended to be followed. There wasn't a grand constitutional convention that ever took place of the leading Jews that said, we're going to do this or do that. It kind of just grew. That's one of the reasons why the Christians and the others never heard about it. Because it didn't happen in any kind of institutional form. It just happened. It's organic. It's spread across the Jewish world. And I would like to be a fly on the wall in a community back in those centuries where somebody came over here, I'm going to be anachronistic. Somebody came to a Yekesha community, so to speak, or Italian community says, can't do this anymore. Can't do this anymore. We've been doing this for 500 years. My Bubby did it. My Zaidi did it. They're very religious. Talmud says you can't do it. What's this Talmud thing? Well, I guarantee you, maybe in the first round there's a fight or two, but as time goes on, sooner or later, everybody's going to get with the program. That is what happened in Jewish history. The people who did not go with the program are called the Karaites, and they were marginalized and iced out and excommunicated and consigned to the status of heresy and all the rest of it. And that is interesting. The Christians don't know this is going on. You understand? This kind of set of transformations. The Talmudization of Judaism, which is a process that can only happen once the Talmud is published as a book, only could take place after the year 500 or so. 500 CE, not BC, the other way, CE. And that means that huge transformations, actually 600, 700, huge transformations characterized Jewish life across the globe, whatever the Jewish globe was in those days, And there wasn't any public national or international outcry about it because it happened on a communal level. Your kid, I know this has never happened in America, but the kid comes back to yeshiva from yeshiva and he says, Mom, we got to stop doing this and we're going to start doing that. And the mother said, we're not going to do that. And 2 weeks later, you do that. Has this ever happened? Okay. And this is in our time. And I wonder if a future historian will even record this. But we've lived through it. So it gives a little bit of an insight what happened 1,500 years ago. There's a new book out there called the Talmud. And, you know, my Rebbe or whatever said this is what you got to do. And that's what you end up doing. Right? You know, kicking or screaming or whatever. And this is what... So what happened is, we're talking about the emergence of a new set of supreme canonical texts within Judaism, displacing the Bible itself, if you want to be perfectly honest. The Torah is the Torah, and that's number one, and the Gemara is the explanation of the Torah, I get that. But Lemaisa, you don't look in the Chumash to see what the din is, all the rest of it. The boys in yeshiva, the Maskilim and the Hebraists, notwithstanding, they don't study Chumash and Bible all day long. They study Talmud. Right? Judaism very heavily went into a Talmudocentric kind of thing and remains that way very heavily down till today, does it not? And although people thought that this was going down the tubes, read the newest, the survey, I'm sure you all know what I'm talking about, they did the survey in New York, all the rest of it. It's the Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox that are the ones that are growing, and the other ones isn't. It's funny. And so the result is that, all across this is the Islamic Empire over here, bigger than the Roman Empire. This process I just told about the Talmudization took place within the context of this empire. Here is Iraq. That's where the Talmud Bavli emerged, right where I'm pointing, right smack in the middle of it, the belly button of the empire. It's right Baghdad. Baghdad was the capital city of the whole business over here, and the famous Jewish cities of Sur and Pumadisa were located nearby, and they vacated there and moved their yeshivas to Baghdad, just as happens in our time. I've said it before, I'll say it again. The Mir yeshiva is not located in a little town called Mir. Right? It's located where the money is. Okay. Same thing with the other schools. They had to move to place. Well, you had to do it. It wouldn't make any sense for them to be in a town called Mir today. It wouldn't make any sense. And so it spreads. It's a complex process, but it spreads all throughout here. And in some fashion, it gets here also into Christian parts as well. How that happens is really not simple to deconstruct. But we know how it happens broadly speaking. Christians don't know about any of this. They don't know there's a new set of books out there that every Jewish community wants to get a copy of or something like that. They don't know that they're sending their kids away at young ages elsewhere to spend years and years studying this kind of stuff and not the Bible. They don't know you're actually producing a Jewish culture in which, for better or worse, the yeshiva boys don't even know the Bible. Yeah? That's the simple fact. We know Shas. Rarely do you find the people that are into Tanakh. So in other words, the Gemara, as we call it generally, emerged as the supreme canonical text within Judaism by, say, the 800s, without the Christians being aware of it. As far as the Christians were concerned, the books that they saw those Jews carrying around and reading were Old Testaments, maybe prayer books, Bible commentaries along the lines of Rashi and other exegetes. Jewish exegesis, commentary on the Bible, all right, that may have interested the Christians from time to time. Rashi actually had a very interesting reception among Christians. They were interested in what he had to say. But the existence of a large and ever-growing body of Talmudic and halachic literature, really large as we know, was a phenomenon which was not on the Christian radar. So to put it in simple terms, they heard of Rashi on the Chumash. They never heard of Rashi on the Talmud. And Rashi's primary importance is on the Talmud. Okay? They just know about it. As far as the Jews are concerned these centuries, they preferred things that way for a number of reasons. Okay? Better that they don't know. Okay? Better they don't know. And by the way, I have, over the course of my life, come to strongly sympathize that every time I hear some fool call up a talk show and start to talk about what Judaism believes, I say, oh, why can't we go back to the old days? Before radio, and some make a fool of the Jewish religion. Okay? It's understood? And so the Jews preferred it that way. First of all, they had disapproved in general of the Septuagint and the whole idea of getting their stuff out there in public. Second of all, and this is really a tricky point, there are a lot of anti-Christian passages in the Talmud, in Talmudic literature. Better the Goyim don't know. That's what they said. If you want to talk about the original ideas in the Talmud, there's a lot of stuff out there This leads us to a consideration of two important matters, very important matters, the Jewish view of Christianity and the Talmud's view of Christianity. The Jews, interestingly, have no point of view in Christianity. You know what I said? Judaism has no point of view in Christianity. The Jews don't have a specific doctrine of how to respond to Christianity. They just held it's baloney from day one. You have to understand what I'm saying. It's very infuriating to a Christian, usually. And I can totally understand why. To say I'm so insignificant that you don't even give the time to think of what I am? What about chopped liver? You know? Christianity, from the very beginnings of it, had a different development. And they have, from then until today, literally today, devoted a great deal of attention, and it matters a lot to them, how to define Judaism and their status vis-a-vis Judaism. Some people probably are a little aware of what goes on in the world. The Catholic Church has undergone tremendous transformations ever since the 1960s in their doctrines towards the Jews, which is a good thing. And the popes these days, especially the last one, John Paul, was much better on this kind of stuff. Some of you know what I'm talking about. Perhaps the others don't. The internal Christian doctrine gives a great deal of weight and attention to how exactly to define themselves vis-a-vis the Jews, because after all, they call themselves the original Jews. You understand? The verus Israel, the true Israel. The whole doctrine of supersessionism is one in which there were the physical Jews, and they've been superseded by the spiritual Jews, the ones who accepted Jesus, but not 100%. They've never totally worked that out. And they've always had a big conflict on this, and they write about it. I'm talking about medieval popes already, are writing about all this, and there's this conflictedness, which is what allowed us to survive. You understand what I'm saying? The conflictedness of it allowed us to survive, because should kill them, but not. They're very bad, but not. You know? Christianity has struggled from day one, I mean this, from day one, to craft a doctrine of how to understand Judaism's place in the world. This is a process that goes on as we speak. I mean it. I'm not telling you that you should all go follow what happens in the Vatican all the time, but if it gets out in regular news, news outlets, that they have a commission on Jewish-Christian relations, and they're constantly working on revising and trying to update their take on the Jews. Until 1965, they spoke about the accursed Jews. Then they did a 180 turn, and then they, but not everybody agreed with that, and they're, battling it out among themselves back and forth, and a certain amount of politics involved in all this. The current Pope, Benedict, if you know anything about him, is extremely interested, as a theologian, precisely in the question of where does Judaism fit into Christian worldview, because how you define Judaism is how you define Christianity. That's where they're fascinated with it. On the other hand, the Jews aren't like that. We came first, and you built on us. We never told you to get on board. You said that you started a whole new. We never bought into that from day one. But how do you define Jesus? How do you define the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost? How do you define it? We have no definition on it. I just know it's not true. You understand? It's very infuriating. You don't have a Jewish commission to study the Christianity? Now, the Reform do. That's for political correct purposes. You see, I know that. But the Orthodox, and I assure you, the Catholic Church is really focused on the Orthodox. They don't have much time for the Reform and the Conservative. If you follow their internal literature, they're really interested in what do the traditional Jews say. Okay? Traditional have nothing to say in subject. And because traditional Judaism had nothing to say in subject, it was a vacuum. And a vacuum, nature abhors a vacuum. So all kind of opinions out there. So you can follow. The Rambam has this set of views. Rashi has a separate set of views. The Meiri is famous for being very pro-Christian, very tolerant toward Christianity. Others say it's total Avodah Zarah. Others say it's this. Others say that. Legends abounded. The reason I mention this is, if you ask, what is the Talmud's opinion on Christianity? Talmud doesn't have an opinion on Christianity. It just is not true. You see? They might have all kinds of stories about Christians, but remember, in the Talmud's time, Christianity was Jewish. Is that true? You see? Time of the Tanaim, the Christians was literally Jews for Jesus. It was a Jewish heresy. You tell me what the rabbis of the Talmud thought of Jewish heretics. You understand? I repeat, if it was a Christian thing, meaning if it's a Gentile thing, they have a completely different, then they have an attitude of non-interest. After all, what is the Talmud's opinion on Chinese religion? Is it most of the people in the world with a Chinese religion? What is the Talmud's opinion on 150 different other religious systems of belief? They have no opinion on it. They consider it, oh, it's not us, whatever, let them do whatever they want. What is the Talmud's opinion of the fact that the Chinese consider themselves the middle kingdom and the chosen people? It's also a game of, oh, you know, fine, let them do it, you know, let them do whatever they want. If you ask really a Talmudist, what do you think about the fact that the Mormons are, you know what I'm talking about, they're converting the neshamas? Let them do it, you know, who cares? You get it? That's the old Talmudic kind of attitude towards this. So as I say before, Christians, when they actually found this out, were very insulted. I mean, you know, you don't even have an anti-opinion to us. You never, whatever, chop, you know, the liver, as I said before. It really ticks off thoughtful Christians. I've had this experience myself. It really ticks off thoughtful Christians if they learn that the Jews, Judaism, does not have a specific opinion of Christianity because they consider it important. Ignoring is more offensive than opposing. Would you agree with that statement? Okay. As always, Judaism, because of its historical development, because we didn't have a country, we didn't have a Sanhedrin, we didn't have any kind of central institutions, developed in a non-doctrinal way. It's kind of funny because we always think nowadays that they're trying to tell you all the Hashkafa stuff. But the fact of the matter is, Judaism, formally speaking, never developed in the way Christianity did, which is with a very precise interest in defining Hashkafas, in defining doctrine. Let me ask you the following question. What happens after you die? Oh, Rashi says this, the Rambam says, I wrote it up in the art school. Yeah? Another one says another thing, the Ramchal is a third thing. What's heaven and hell? What's the reward and punishment? Define the word God. Define the word angel. There's no official position of the Jewish religion on any of this. There's just different opinions of great scholars. Yeah? I'll tell you another one. How's the Mashiach coming? That's a biggie. Right? The Rambam says this way, the Lubavitch says another way, Shabtai says the third way, this one says the fourth way, Rashi says, how's the temple coming back? Rashi says it's coming down heaven and fire, the Rambam says it's going to be built by, so who's right? That's the point, they never said somebody's right, there's just a bunch of opinions out there. You know what I'm saying? Nor was there an attempt in the Talmud, or in the culture coming out of the Talmud, to force everybody, with rare exceptions, to force everybody in some kind of a straitjacket, you have to hold from this and this position. As a matter of fact, this kind of, I don't call it freedom of speech, but let's put it that way. Sometimes, as happens with freedom of speech, did get out of hand. And these are the Maimonidean controversies. In the century after the death of the Rambam, there are people who pushed the envelope too far to the left, shall we say, and offended the consensus of the Jews and caused all kind of outbreaks and fights in Provence and in northern Spain. I'll give you an example. When they said, I'll just share a tiny bit of this. Is everything in the Bible literal? No. How do you say it's not? No. The Chazal don't believe it either, right? Let's put it this way. Did God come down and listen to Saddam? God doesn't come down. How do you know? God doesn't come down. How do you know? Shira Shirim. It got into the Bible or didn't get into the Bible? It got into the Bible. Song of Songs. As X-rated. How did it get? Oh, it's a mashal. It says no. It's a boy and a girl. It's a mashal. Even, no, I'm trying to show you, even Talmudic times, some things they don't do literally. Once you open that, it's a Pandora's box. So how do you know what's literal and what's not literal? If it can't be, it makes absolutely no sense, then it can't be literal. It must be a mashal. It must be an allegory. Interesting. So what if I have an issue with saying that Abraham lived really 180 years, 175 years? Maybe it's allegory. Maybe you tell me Sarah had a baby. People wrote like this. Sarah had a baby when she was 100 years old. Maybe it's an allegory. Moses split the Red Sea. Come on. It's really an allegory, right? The donkey of Bilam spoke. It becomes a wholly subjective thing. Anything I don't like, I call an allegory. It's called the Maimonidean controversies. They argued over this very heavily. But what I can tell you is, that, like we would say today, Slifkin. You understand? These kind of things. But there was no congress of Jewish rabbis or people who got together like the Vatican and said, all right, here's the official doctrine. Never was even an attempt to do that. So Christianity arose in a doctrinal manner, not so interested in the little details of ceremonial practice. Judaism was the opposite. We go crazy over whether or not an egg which is born in Yontov can be eaten or not, right? If you tie the shoe this way or not, the Christians can't understand it. But the Jews can't understand the Christianity, their preoccupation with theological doctrine, finiteness. You know, did Jesus have a nose or he didn't have a nose? Does it look like a nose or wasn't a nose? You know, is Mary really his mother? Is not really his mother? And the Jews said, what is all that? So the two religious traditions came out of very different kinds of ways of thinking, and therefore it's not surprising that the Jews never developed an official doctrinal position on Christianity. What can I do? This is complicated, of course, by the Talmud's writing against Christianity, because, as I said before, they were heretics in the Talmudic times. You understand that the 19th bracha in the Shemoneh Esrei is originally against these heretics. Right? The Lamashinim, they call now, originally is Laminim. So, and at the end of the day, anybody knows the Talmud knows you can find agadic statements on both sides of any issue. I mean, yeah. You'll find some who say that this is good, and some say this is bad. And this is good. So which one are you picking, and how do you know yours is right? So there you have it. But, again, the Talmud clearly is of the opinion Christianity is something not good and not real. It doesn't have so many complimentary things to say about the Umos Olam either, to be perfectly honest, although once in a while they do. And this is the big problem, because now you're living under the Christians. So you definitely don't want these books to get out there, because they'll get them angry, naturally. In general, Christian ignorance about sweeping developments in Judaism was matched by Jewish ignorance about sweeping developments in Christianity. St. Augustine and the other seminal early Christian thinkers were as unknown to the Jews as Ravina and Ravashi were unknown to the non-Jews. Understand this well. There's physical proximity. Jews live in Rome. I was just there. And I'm sure some of you were also. They live not far away from the Pope. And certainly in the rest of Europe. So physically they're there. But mentally, it's two different places. In the old days. It's the cultural insularity that I've spoken of elsewhere. And the Christian doesn't know about St. Augustine, and he doesn't know about the church fathers, and he doesn't care. And vice versa. And this guy doesn't care about Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Ravashi and all the rest of it. There were no formal Jewish writings in Christianity, just legends, like the Toldos Yeshu. They did emerge in the Amoraic period. Nobody knows exactly when. A whole bunch of legends. Perhaps you've heard about it. Now this is the real story of Yeshu of Jesus. Oh, you know, he was an illegitimate child, and he was a magician, and this and the other. He flew in the air, and somebody pitched on him and shot him down. And all that. I promise you, crazy stories. All the rest of it. The Queen Helen, and it was done on Queen Helen, who was the Queen of the Jews. There was no such thing as Queen Helen, the Queen of the Jews. You know what I'm saying? It's a bunch of legends, but it got out there in the, what should I say, the Jewish urban legend arena, and still there today. It's a vacuum. So therefore, something comes in to fill the vacuum. But ultimately, Judaism had nothing to say about Christianity. Jews came to live among Christians outside Italy, more or less in Charlemagne's time. There's our friend Charlemagne, right? And Charlemagne became the emperor in the year 800, the Holy Roman Emperor. By this time, the Catholic Church was in the process of dominating most of Europe. The Church had worked out its own ideas of Jews and Judaism in the universe, physical and spiritual. There's a whole elaborate doctrine, as I say before. The Jews, according to Christian view, could not be treated as just another non-Christian group. On the contrary, Jesus was born a Jew. The Bible stated Jews have been a chosen people. Even if they screwed up by rejecting the Christian Savior, the Church could not develop a consensus that the Jews are now reduced to non-chosenness. Interesting, right? They just in potential chosenness. I don't want to give a whole Christian lecture over here, but the bottom line is that they believe eventually they'll all come to see the light. It's written in the Gospels, you know what I'm saying? And that will be the sign of their re-chosenness, as it were. And until then, Christians have to sort of patiently await this kind of business. It's good for us they came up with this. You understand? There had to be a conflicted attitude towards the Jews, and there was in Roman Catholicism. There were enough positive statements in the New Testament about the Jews as there were negative ones. And basically, dealer's choice as to which set of statements would influence Christian attitudes towards the Jews. As far as the Jews are concerned, they're the helpless minority. They had no choice but to throw themselves on the mercy of the popes early on, like in the 500s already. Gregory the Great, one of the early and most famous popes, formulated the basic policy, and it's really interesting. This is central Catholic teaching since the year 500 or so. That's a long time. which came to be formalized in a papal bull. That's a bull means you put it, Pope puts a stamp on it. It's an official decree called Sicut Judaeus, which is really fascinating. Look what it says over here. This is from the original popes. The Jews ought to suffer no prejudice. We, out of the meekness of Christian piety, and in keeping with the footprints of our predecessors, of happy memory, the Roman pontiff so-and-so and such, admit their petition. Meaning, we grant the Jews what they're asking for, which, as you'll see, is physical security. And we grant them the buckler, or the shield, of our protection. This is the Pope talking. For we make the law that no Christian compel them, unwilling or refusing, by violence, to come to baptism. You're not allowed to... It's interesting. This is sent people that most Jews don't even know this exists. This is central teachings of the church. But if any one of them should spontaneously and for the sake of the faith fly to the Christians, meaning if he does it lishma, then once his choice has been evident, let him be made a Christian without any calumny. Indeed, he's not considered to possess the true faith of a Christianity if anyone who is not recognized to have come to Christian baptism, not spontaneously but unwillingly. So if you force somebody, it doesn't really count because he didn't mean it. You see, it's got to be... Two, also, no Christian ought to presume to injure their persons. Would you consider that an important statement? Okay. Or with violence to take their property or to change the good customs which they have had until now in whatever region they inhabit. Meaning, you can't mess with Shabbos. And if they wear funny clothes or tzitzis, that's the good, you know, it's been around for a long time, and tradition is that they can do this. What we're really seeing over here is a leftover from the Roman Empire, because the Catholic Church, among other things, assumed the role, consciously, of the Roman Empire, and everybody in the Vatican, see this in a second, of the Roman Empire, and they consider themselves still the Pontifex Maximus, the high priest and successor to the leaders of Rome, and by the time Constantine came along, ever since the Emperor Caracalla in the early 200s, Judaism had been recognized as a licit religion, not an illicit religion, but a licitas, which means a real religion and not some crazy thing. And these traditions survived in interesting ways into the Catholic Church, as you see over here. Look at this. Besides, in the celebration of their own festivities, no one ought to disturb them in any way with clubs or stones. I mean, I wish we could rely on that, you know, you wouldn't need the showman, nor on anyone... anyone to require him or to extortion of services they do not owe, except for those they've been accustomed times to pass to perform. So in other words, taxes and things like that, they have to pay. But ordinarily, they're the inferiors, but, you see my point? And by the way, this is what the Jew wants. Agreed? The Jew's not asking in the Middle Ages for citizenship and first-class treatment. This will do. We decree that no one dare mutilate or diminish a Jewish cemetery. Yeah, you and I know what goes on today. We read every week in the paper, you read it, unfortunately. Right? But it's against the church team. Nor in order to get money to exhume bodies once they've been buried. So it must be the popes were told that some Christian people were doing this to help the Jewish community for money. They say, you know, you don't pay me, I'll go to your parents to a grave. Like that. The pope said, this is wrong. If anyone shall attempt the tenor of the decree once known to go against it, known if anyone hurts the Jews against what I'm telling you, let him be punished by the vengeance of excommunication, which is a big deal in Catholicism, unless he corrects his presumption by making equivalent satisfaction, unless he does teshuva. So the point is that you say, no, it's interesting. Remember, according to them, we killed their God. According to them, they shouldn't be doing this. I'm trying to show you history is more interesting than fiction. I never understand why people waste their time reading fiction. Okay? This is more interesting than fiction. Here, a religious Jew would say like this. This is Yad Hashem. Doesn't make any sense that the church itself should emerge as the protector of the Jews, at least officially. Now, by the way, the Jews pay plenty of good money to have it, but that doesn't mean anything. You pay good money to get anything in the Middle Ages, and if you want to know the honest truth, you do it today. They call it APAC, but they do the same thing today. Okay? So, the fact is that, just to get fair treatment, not special treatment. Just to get fair treatment. None of this, all this is saying is treat them like human beings. It's not saying elevate them and exalt them and give them fancy privilege or anything like that. It says don't destroy their cemetery. What kind of a jerk are you want to do that? Don't beat them up when they're going to their services. Because the Jewish services is not Christian services at all. But the Jewish service has a legitimacy of their own. There's the conflictedness that I just told you about. There are cursed people. There are the church will call them all kinds of names and put all kinds of things against them. And yet, right? And yet. And so you see over here this kind of funny thing. It's physical security combined with theological condescension. But condescension can be a cover for lack of self-confidence. Would you agree with that statement? All the things they say about Christianity, they don't feel 100% comfortable in their superstition of Judaism. Protection for the Jewish religion and ceremonies. The Pope has no idea, though, that when you say you have to protect the Jews at their ceremonies, he has no idea that these ceremonies are governed by the Talmud, because these don't even know it exists. He thinks it's the Old Testament. It's what you call in Hebrew, Mekach Tos. It was a mistake. Overall, it's important to realize that the church had a full plate, coming to the end here, had a full plate in the first half of the Middle Ages, conquering and Christianizing barbarian Europe. Charlemagne wiped out the Germanic tribes that wouldn't buckle and go Christian, and he spread it by the sword and all this sort of thing. Charlemagne was good to the Jews. He wasn't good to the Christian pagans, the German pagans. Also, there was, pay attention, I'm about to tell you, a 1,500-year war going on between Christianity and Islam. It's still going on today. Look at this. Here's the Roman Empire, all this. Here's the Middle East, when it was owned by the Romans and Christians. Then, that's round one. Then in round two, the Muslims took it all away. Then in round three came the Crusades. Wait a minute, go back, Jake. It came the Crusades and retook all this. And then in round four, the Muslims got it all back. And in round five, the Muslims went on the offensive. And let's do the next map. And took over a third of Europe. This is Budapest. That's how far they were. Okay, the Turkish Empire. Then, you can skip the map, in round six, is it? The Christians took back all of Europe. And round seven, which is being waged today, the Muslims are taking over Europe again. This is a war that went on back and forth. You can't say it in public. The Pope is very well aware of this, I assure you. Okay? They're very well aware of this. And so, my point is like this. The church had bigger fish to fry than the Jews. That was good for the Jews. In the first half of the Middle Ages, they had a full plate to keep them occupied, in doing great and immense things, conquering and Christianizing whole areas, setting up monasteries, and very impressive church culture. You can't knock it, and you know, we're not Christian, but they developed an impressive Christian civilization of their own and all the rest of that sort of thing. They were mainly concerned with the wars that were being waged with the Muslims over there. All this diverted attention away from the Jews, and therefore, there wasn't that much direct pressure upon the Jews, and nobody paid too much attention to what the Jews are actually doing in their backyard. Nobody knows who Rashi really is, except that he's a big Jewish scholar, you know what I mean? Even in France, like the Talmud, or what, you know, what's all that? And we can't have, as I say before, any kind of meaningful arguments, disputations, because Pshat Remez Drash Sod. The Christian wants to talk at the level of Christian Sod, the Jew wants to talk at the level of Pshat. I mean, they're talking past each other. The mutual unawareness comes to an end in the 13th century with the pontificate of this guy, Pope Innocent III, perhaps the most impressive of medieval popes. I mean, everybody agrees to that. And a guy who caused us a lot of trouble. That's something that we'll pick up next week.